In this hour of Focus 580, we will be looking at the relationship between society and technology. And most of the time when we talk about that, we look at the ways in which technology shapes society. And certainly that's appropriate because in many, many ways, technology does shape the way that we live. But this is not just a one-way relationship. It is also the case that society determines the directions of technology. And that is the topic that we'll be talking about here this morning, how it is that society shapes technology. We will be talking with the author of a book that has that phrase as its subtitle. The book is titled Beyond Engineering, How Society Shapes Technology. And our guest, the author, is Robert Poole. It's a book that was first published by Oxford University Press back in the summer of 1997 and then came out in a paperback edition just last May. So the book is available if you'd like to look at it. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore, possibly in the library. Also, this book was the basis for a program that will premiere on many PBS stations around the country this week, and in fact will be airing the show on Sunday. It's called The Next Big Thing, and you can see that program on WILL-TV on Sunday, this coming Sunday at 6 o'clock in the evening, and then it will air on other public stations too. So if you get your public TV from some other station, you check local listings and find out when the program will air. We'll talk about some of the ideas that you can find in this program and in this book this morning with Robert Poole. As we do, of course, questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, the number in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Poole, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Quite welcome.
How is it that you started to look at this particular relationship, that is, how society shapes technology, particularly since we so often, when talking about this relationship, we look at the other way around?
Right. I actually backed into it. It's a long story in itself, and I actually tell the story at the beginning of the book. I started off to write a book about nuclear power, one more book about nuclear power, although this one was going to be about the coming generation of nuclear reactors that are being built, and with a look back at what happened to nuclear power in the past and why it didn't turn out to be quite the panacea that everyone had hoped some 50 years ago. And I found it difficult as I started writing the book to get a handle on it, because I had started with the idea that I was going to find the answers to what went wrong with nuclear power and the engineering details, the designs of the plants, the risk assessments, and maybe some mistakes that were made along the way there. The more I read about it, the more I studied it, the more I spoke with people about it, the more it became obvious that the actual technical features of nuclear power were probably less important to how it all turned out and less important to my book than the way that society reacted to nuclear power, and society in the broad sense. I'm talking about political influences, market influences, the psychology of the individuals, psychology of groups, and so on. And so the book took a turn on me, and I suddenly found myself writing about how society had in some way shaped nuclear power. But as I continued to read more and more about it, I discovered once again that it was not just nuclear power that you could say this about, but that pretty much any technology that you look at out there, if you look at it closely enough, you find that the way it ultimately turns out is indeed dependent upon the guys there in the rooms with the drawing pads and the calculators, the engineers, but it also is very strongly dependent upon many factors besides what the engineers decide is the best way to design this technology. And so the book became a sort of general look at all of the factors outside the technical ones, outside the decisions that the engineers themselves make based purely on engineering ideas and principles that shape a technology, and that's the title, Beyond Engineering, How Society Shapes Technology.
I think it's a really interesting way of looking at it, because I think it's our perception that so often when new technologies come along, they are that we don't have a lot of choice in whether we adopt them or not, that we're sort of victims of the technology, that it's kind of dumped on us, that the developers say, here it is, you'll love it, it's great, and then we have to live with it and we don't have a great deal of choice. But in fact, when you look at going back some ways as different technologies came along, you do in fact appreciate that people's willingness to use something or not use something, or the various attitudes or prejudices or mindset or experiences that they bring to the new technology, can go a long way in determining whether that technology succeeds or falls by the wayside, and that it may not have a great deal to do with, or as much as you would think, to do with whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea just on the face of it.
Right. You're exactly right, David. It's actually very empowering, because people can, especially today when we have these huge technologies and huge corporations developing them, we sometimes can feel that we're just overwhelmed with technology, that something comes out and we really have no say over it, that we're just presented with it, and at most the only say we have is a yay or nay, yes we like it or no we don't, so it's either going to succeed or fail. But that's not the case at all. The directions that the technologies take are also shaped very much by individuals as well as these other factors. And when you realize that, you begin to realize that as an individual, you can make some sort of difference in the direction that technology takes. And that is a very empowering realization.
Well, maybe we should give some examples so people will get a sense of what it is that we're talking about. You did talk a little bit about nuclear, using nuclear power to generate electricity, and that might be one, or maybe that might be something else.
Let me offer one of the ones that people are very familiar with, and that's just the personal computer. It got its start back in the 70s. In fact, you can trace it back somewhat earlier than that, but it got its start with just a tool for hobbyists, and it was never understood as something that was going to be of general interest. Computers were available for businesses at this time, but they were these big things that you needed to make a big investment to buy, and you needed a big place to put them, and you needed people to run them, and no one was really thinking in terms of computers for individuals, and so these things got started off as little hobbyist kits, basically. People could put them together and play with them. And it went on from there. And there were two, in the end, there were two very different sorts of approaches to personal computers that came to dominate. And one of them was the IBM approach, the company that had its name made on these big computers that companies had been using for decades. And when IBM came into the market and said, we're going to build our own personal computer called the PC, then that suddenly set a standard, and everybody looked at it as, well, the personal computer has arrived. Now maybe I can take a look at the personal computer and decide if I want to buy one. If IBM's involved, it must be real. And so IBM's entrance into the market set a standard, but it was the type of computer that IBM offered was very much shaped by the corporate culture at IBM. It was a business culture. It was aimed at business people, and it was in particular aimed at the sorts of people that could take a little bit of time and understand how to run a computer. These were serious people who used computers for serious things. So the IBM computer came out as very much a business-oriented sort of thing. On the other side of the spectrum, there was a small company out in California that had gotten involved as hobbyists, originally making these kits for hobbyists, and that was Apple Computer. And this was a completely different culture. It was a couple of old, well, they weren't so old at this time, a couple of hippies from California that had started the company. And this was a computer for the people, very consciously designed to be not a corporate thing, but something for individuals, a way of increasing your freedom and your ability to do things and enjoy life. And so the way the Apple was designed was very different. It was very consciously made to be easily accessible to people, that they could learn how to use the Apple computers very easily. And so you were presented with two very different visions of a computer. And this was not something that the engineers really had a lot of say over. This was more shaped by corporate culture than anything else. And once it got out into the marketplace, what you've actually seen has been a convergence. The IBM types of computers have come to take on many of the user-friendly attributes that the Apple had, particularly with the Windows operating system now, that basically is a knockoff of what Apple was doing in the early days. So at that point, once it got out into the marketplace and people started making a difference, the technology started to take on the attributes that people indicated that they liked. And now the IBM-compatible computers are a very different creature because of that. But the whole history and shaping of the personal computer is something that is you can't understand unless you look at the factors that are non-technical, non-engineering factors.
Hmm. Let me take this opportunity to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Robert Poole. And if you're interested in reading some of the ideas here that we're discussing, you should look for a book that he wrote. The title of the book is Beyond Engineering: How Society Shapes Technology. First came out in 1997 and is now available in a paperback edition published by the Oxford University Press. That came out last May, and so the book should be available. And also, the book is a basis for a program that's going to air on many public television stations here in the next few days, on ours as well. The title of the show is The Next Big Thing, and it will premiere on many stations around the country on Friday, tomorrow. On our station, you can see this program on Sunday, 6 o'clock in the evening on WILL-TV. So if you're interested in some exploration of these subjects, you can look at the show, and then maybe you want to go on from there and take a look at Mr. Poole's book. Questions, of course, are welcome too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have that, so that's for local folks. We also have the toll-free line. That's good. If it would be a long-distance call for you, 800-222-9455. I think also one of the things that you write about, and when you were talking about the personal computer, this came to my mind, is that within the development of technology, a certain momentum can build up behind something that is really difficult to fight. And I don't know if this is the proper connection, but I think about the personal computer and wonder if, for example, today, if we had sort of no history of the personal computer, if today we decided to build one and design one, what would it look like? I don't know if it would look like the things that we have now. And it seems that our attempts to break out of that pattern, to do something different, are hampered by the fact that we are used to thinking of it being a certain object in a certain way, that we interface with in a certain way, and once you build up enough momentum behind a certain approach or a certain thing, it becomes hard and maybe impossible even to imagine doing it differently.
Absolutely. It's exactly that way with the Windows operating system, which, as I said, had its roots in the old Apple operating system. And the whole idea, and actually that goes back even further to something that was developed by Xerox, actually, and never successfully marketed, but the idea of files and folders and using a mouse to move things around on your screen. A few people came up with that idea as a way that seemed easy for humans to interface with computers, and it, through various historical accidents, came to be the dominant system that we have now. Now, it would never have become dominant if it weren't something that people found relatively easy to use. But if no one had ever thought of it in the first place, if the guys working at Xerox had been doing something else and had never come up with this idea, we would certainly have a very different sort of way of interfacing with our computer than we have right now. And we might be just as happy with it. We might be even more happy with it than we are with Windows. There's no way of knowing, of course, but what we can say is that right now we're pretty much set on this path. It's not very likely that we're going to have a way of interfacing with our computers anytime in the near future that's significantly different than what we have now. There'll be minor improvements and modifications, but we have been trained now to think of interacting with our computers in this particular way. There's this tremendous economic and social momentum that has been built up. To do it in a different way would demand retraining millions, hundreds of millions of people. It would cost individual companies much more money than they would want to spend to retrain everybody, and individuals would have to learn something completely new. And unless there were some overwhelming reason to do that, some overwhelming advantage that you could see in moving to a new system, it simply wouldn't happen. And furthermore, you're not likely to ever see that overwhelming advantage clearly enough in a new technology that has yet to be truly developed. Let me move a little bit over in a parallel track and talk mm-hmm. about the keyboard itself on the computer, which goes back to our old typewriter keyboards and which goes back to the invention of the typewriter in the late 1800s. The layout of the keys is known as the QWERTY layout because of the first six letters there on the second row, Q-W-E-R-T-Y. And the reason that those are laid out is basically a historical one. Someone working on one of the early typewriters for the Remington Company laid out the keys in a particular way. One of the things they wanted to do was have all of the letters that spelled out typewriter on one line. This typewriter was actually the brand name of the thing that they had created, and they wanted their salesman to be able to type out the word typewriter without their fingers moving from that one line. They moved some of the keys around because they found that they wanted to get commonly used keys far enough apart that people would have to kind of move their fingers more around the keyboard to hit the commonly used keys. Otherwise, they might type a little bit too fast and the keys would jam. So we get this QWERTY keyboard for historical reasons more than anything else. There have been various attempts to replace it with something that is a better keyboard to use that you can type faster on. The one that people seem to like best is called the Dvorak keyboard. It was laid out in a very scientific way so that people who learn to type on the Dvorak can type more words a minute than you can on QWERTY. It's not a huge amount, maybe 5 to 10%, but it's a better keyboard. But you simply cannot replace the QWERTY keyboard with the Dvorak keyboard because it would demand such an investment of time and money, people learning to type all over again. Now, companies that have done this, the Navy did this in the Second World War, have found that their typists do indeed type faster once they learn to work with the Dvorak keyboard, but it's not going to happen in society as a whole. We've built up this momentum for the QWERTY keyboard, and there is just not enough advantage in moving to another one to make it worth our while to switch. So this is, again, the sort of thing that happens in shaping a technology. For completely, almost random reasons, you can get stuck on one sort of technology like this QWERTY keyboard that may not be as good as other technologies, but once you've invested in it, once people have learned how to use it, once companies have invested in training programs and bought this particular technology, it becomes very difficult to switch over to another technology. And the phrase for that is actually technological lock-in, a phrase that the economist Brian Arthur invented, and Arthur has studied this whole idea of technological lock-in in some detail.
Yeah, that gets at one of the basic questions that you deal with, and I think it's a very interesting one. That is, how is it that we do become locked into technologies or way of doing things that are not optimal? That one explanation is, as you've offered, is that things become so firmly entrenched or become so attached to them that the idea of doing something else, even if it would make sense, becomes so overwhelming that it's just not possible, or at least we say, well, it would be more trouble than it was worth.
And it's usually not even there are some psychological barriers. That's certainly true, but I think the stronger barriers are the economic ones and the training ones. when you you look at, for instance, the gasoline-powered automobile, we have this tremendous infrastructure developed for the gas automobile, with gasoline filling stations, with repair shops, with the manufacturers. If we are to go to a different kind of automobile, say an electric-powered one, the investment in the new infrastructure, in training people to repair it and to work on it, service it, is absolutely outrageous. You have to have a very, very strong reason to move from this particular technology to another one to justify spending all of that time and effort and money to redo everything that we have spent decades building up at this point. So technology is something that gets just tied into the entire fabric of society. And when you stop to think about, okay, if I want to change this one technology, what is it going to entail? You find that you're going to have to change an amazing amount of things. There's a ripple effect. And so once you have been using a technology for a while and have truly invested in it, that is where you get your lock-in. And the only times you switch are when there's a relatively easy path that you can take to switch, because you can do incremental changes, or when there is a very clear and strong reason for making that change. Now, if the gasoline engine is causing so much pollution that places like California decide that they can't live with it anymore, that's a strong reason, and maybe we have to switch to a new technology there. But that will not be easy, and it would never happen on its own. It would have to be something that was imposed from above.
I wonder, could you give an example or two of cases where really superior technologies failed not because there was anything wrong with them, but for the other kinds of reasons that we've talked about?
You have to be careful when you say really superior. There, first of all, it's very difficult to measure two technologies because you don't really know which one is going to be superior until each has been fully developed and you have a chance to measure the two of them side by side. And it almost never happens that the two of them are fully developed. Generally, you make a decision somewhere early in the development when it's not clear which is going to be the superior one. And so you kind of have to guess. Well, engineering calculations show that this is probably going to be a better technology, but we can't be sure because there might be some problems down the path that we haven't figured out yet. And so that's part of the calculation. The other caveat I want to issue here is that if there is a clearly superior technology and it's superior enough, then you generally will make the switch. It's when there is not enough of a superiority, but it's still some superiority that you don't make the switch. Like with Dvorak versus QWERTY, the improvement you get in typing speed is probably 5 to 10%. Now, if you could double or triple the number of words you could type per minute on a typewriter keyboard, I bet you that you would see the new keyboard appearing very quickly. But when you only have 5 to 10% difference, then the investment is not really worth it. So you have to be careful what you mean by what you say by truly superior. But one example that people are familiar with is just with our videotapes. Everybody pretty much agrees that the Sony Betamax was a pretty much a far superior format to the VHS format that came to dominate. And what happened there was the two came out at about the same time, and for reasons that nobody quite understands at this point, the VHS got an initial lead, and so more movies came out on the VHS format, which means people went into the stores to see what movies were available. Well, there were more available on VHS, so they'd buy a VHS video player, and that meant that because there were more people buying the VHS systems, the manufacturers made more VHS videotapes available, and you just had this feedback loop where it got the advantage grew and grew and grew until the Sony system just dropped out because not enough people were interested in it. The VHS is a perfectly good system. The advantages that the Sony Betamax had over it were technical ones, and you would see them on your television screen. They're somewhat better, but not enough better that when people were first making the choice between the Sony and the VHS formats, that they had a reason to pick one over the other simply because of the formats. Instead, they would look at which had more movies available or something like that, which had the cheaper video cassette player. So this is what happens. You can point to little things like that. There are good reasons to believe, for instance, that the type of nuclear reactor that we ended up with is probably not the best nuclear reactor that you could build. It's a good nuclear reactor. There's no real problems with it. But if you look at it and ask, well, if we had chosen one of these other types of nuclear reactors and it had spent as much money and as much time developing it as we did developing the light water reactor, would it be a better reactor? And a lot of people think, yes, that we could have made a choice for a better nuclear reactor. But that's not going to happen now because we've got decades and I don't know how many tens of billions of dollars spent developing a particular type of nuclear reactor. Nobody's going to go back and start from scratch with a new one, a new type of nuclear reactor, and try to say we've got a better system here, buy ours instead.
We have several callers now to bring into the conversation, and I'll again introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Robert Poole. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for his book, Beyond Engineering, How Society Shapes Technology. It's published by the Oxford University Press. It is available now in a paperback edition. Or you also might go to the library and look for his book, which came out in hardcover in 1997, same publisher. And also, you might want to keep in mind that there will be a program that was inspired by his book, running on a lot of public television stations coming soon. And in fact, it'll be on our TV station, WILL-TV, Sunday at 6. The program is titled The Next Big Thing. Questions welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free, 800-222-WILL. First caller here in line is in Champaign County, and it's line number 4. Hello.
I only have a moment, so I guess I'll hit to the major point I was going to go on about the graphical interface as the other thing that people compare to beta and Apple's introduction of it and the fact that they actually did pay for it, but the court case that was against Microsoft failed. But what I think is more important is this idea that nuclear power, you know, I think it's thinking outside of the box is hard to do, but I think the whole idea of the centralized power generation plant is, I think, the problem. There's a major engineering firm in Switzerland, Energy Consulting, I forget the acronym for it, but they're declaring that the grid is dead and that what we need to look at is more localized generation, whether it's mixed formats of fuel cells, but generating the stuff more locally to its use. These are possibilities, but the problem is the vested interests, it seems to me, are the ones that want to keep the power generation centralized, and their handmaiden is government, and they're not going to do any of the programs that are necessary to, even the subsidy of solar didn't come back under the 8 years of Clinton, particularly. It's not just people's druthers or what they're used to. I think there's vested interests that have a huge stake in this, and that's why we have, locally Dynergy buying Illinois Power, but splitting off the power plant and the Clinton plant here. I don't know. It's a broader issue that I don't have time to paint too well, but I don't know how well it resonates with you. I guess I'll listen and take the answer off the air. But I think the point is that it's not just people are used to going to the mains for their electricity. It's also that there's, capital says this is the way we do it. This is the way we can control it. We don't want anybody, subsidizing or advocating using government to try to develop a different alternate future. All right. Well, I will hang up and, like I say, take my blue
on the air. Well, excellent point there, Mr. Poole. What do you think?
I think he's dead on. It's exactly the sort of thing that I'm talking about. I didn't mention that specifically, but there is a tremendous amount of momentum or inertia, if you prefer, that's created by business investment. Once businesses, very large businesses, have invested in a particular approach to technology, it's very difficult to move away from that because they have a lot of money and a lot of institutional momentum built up in that direction. And it's difficult to underestimate. You shouldn't underestimate the institutional inertia here because a company gets vested in thinking about and doing things a particular way, and they really understand that particular way. They know the pluses and minuses of it, and they are focused on that way of doing things, and there's nothing malignant about it. It's perfectly benign, but they truly believe that they have the right approach, that they have thought about it clearly, that other approaches have their problems that simply rule them out, and they'll fight for it. And one of the ways they fight for it is try to prevent other competitors from arising. And yes, when they see the government talking about maybe providing some subsidies to a competing technology, they'll go to their congressman and their senator and say, this is a bad idea. We really don't want you providing subsidies to this. And then they'll give them a list of reasons for why it's a bad idea and put as much pressure on them as they can. So, yeah, you definitely see that sort of inertia against new technologies as well. It's an institutional inertia, and it's very difficult for a large company that's vested, that's put lots of money and lots of time into a particular approach to a technology, to turn and go in a different direction. And it's equally difficult for them to see a competitor arise that may threaten them. So the caller is exactly right about that.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. This is Champagne, line one. Hello.
I think the previous caller raised something that would be perfect for topic for entire show, maybe more than one. I'd really like to hear that. And moving away from the nuclear can of worms, back to when you're talking about the keyboard and the inefficiency of that. And in fact, I see a lot of people with repetitive stress problems because of their interactions with the keyboard and the mouse. But I think, and correct me if you disagree, but speaking of the next thing, I think that it seems kind of obvious that within the next few years, part of the standard operating system of computers will be voice recognition.
That would be great fun. I'm not that familiar with the pluses and minuses of that, but I don't see any sort of great inertia that would prevent that from coming around if indeed it's something that people like. In fact, the whole history of the personal computer has been that people very quickly adapt new things that are made available if they serve a purpose. So if somebody develops a voice recognition system that works for people, I suspect that it will very quickly come to be something that people use. Now, my guess, just from the way I use computers, is that it would probably be more useful in the handheld devices and things like that where you don't have a full-size keyboard. I'm a writer, and I've been typing on a computer for a long time, and I personally can't see typing my books or my magazine articles by speaking instead of by sitting at a keyboard. But maybe somebody coming along just in a junior high school or something, instead of learning to type on a computer keyboard, they'll learn to speak at the computer, and it will seem perfectly natural to them. But my own personal bias is the keyboard has a lot of things going for it, and it may not be easy to replace as far as just sitting at your desk and typing, but I suspect that it will, the voice recognition systems will become very useful in other areas where a keyboard is not as convenient.
Well, yeah, a lot of people aren't aren't very speedy typers.
Right.
And And also, like I said, there's a lot of injury because of the really, you know, archaic keyboard layout that causes a lot of strenuous reaching and people who have to spend their entire day rather than just a couple of hours, you know, typing, it would be, I think, a huge benefit.
Yeah, you're probably right. I know that when I'm working in the middle of a book and doing 6, 8, 10 hours a day, my wrists get really sore after a while. So at that point, you may be exactly right. But I would be very interested to see how it works because I would just have to try it out. It would be interesting to see. But one of the things that I do feel that I would continue to use the keyboard and the mouse for is moving text around and erasing things. And when you're looking at something you've just written and you say, ah, I didn't want that word, I wanted something else, it seems to me it's going to be a lot faster to use your keyboard to go back up to that word and erase it instead of trying to instruct the computer which word you want to change and where it is. They may be able to do that in a way that's very quick, but I suspect it'll be simply, you know, you read something in and it appears on your screen, and then you'll probably continue to work with it with your keyboard and your mouse, that those aren't going to go away, that the voice recognition may be something that is an add-on to what we already have.
Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest the keyboard would disappear. I just think that, you know, probably be something that you'll supplement rather than use solely.
Of course, with people with disabilities, it would be just a lifesaver. I've often wondered how I could survive if I wasn't able to move my fingers. And at that point, I decided that I absolutely would have to have a voice recognition system because I would want to continue writing, but there wouldn't be any other way to do it. So, yeah, and it seems like it's, I don't know much about it, but from what I've seen in the newspapers, it seems like it's not too far away. Do you know anything more about that?
Well, IBM has ViaVoice out, and they just upgraded it to a more enhanced system.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's coming along, and computers get more powerful, and that's the real, you know, the thing that really is the limiting factor is the power of the computer more, I think, than the software capabilities, but they both developed. So, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Urbana for someone else here, line number two.
Yeah, I bought a video recorder about 15 years ago,
uh-huh.
And the salesperson went on and on about the virtues of Betamax.
Uh-huh.
And that's a technology that I think is superior to VCR, but has lost out.
Yeah, in fact, we just talked about that
a little bit ago,
and I think what you say is correct. And in fact, at our house this Christmas, we got a DVD player, and we had to find some place to put it. So finally, I unplugged. Well, actually, it wasn't even plugged in. It was just sitting there, my Betamax. And if anybody listening, I'll make them a good deal on a used Betamax if there's anybody who wants one. I finally got the old box out and put it into the box. And I think, like you and a lot of people and everybody I knew said, well, Beta is definitely the better technology. You get a better picture. So,
right.
Well, I went out and bought one of those, and it was good for about, I don't know, five years or something. And then pretty soon there was nothing to rent anymore, and finally I had to break down and buy a VHS machine.
It was the better picture that was the selling point, because I was not buying a video recorder at that point. So I did not talk to any salesman. It's all been this has all been just reading for me. So.
Well, I believe that was the argument that it was a superior. The picture quality was superior.
Because I believe there were also some engineering features that you may not have seen as a consumer until it came time to repair it or something like that. But I believe that there were also some of those features that were superior. But so it was the picture that was the main selling point for people going into the store. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I'm interested, maybe you might talk a little bit about, and I note that the program that I've mentioned, The Next Big Thing, deals with, is a technology that's on the horizon that a lot of people feel is a very good technology, and that's the fuel cell.
Right.
It thinks that the kind of thing that could be very useful in powering vehicles and, in fact, in other sort of power applications too, a device that combines hydrogen and oxygen, produces energy and some water as the byproduct. It doesn't create pollution, and seems to be very promising. And yet, there are a number of things going for it, and that there are a number of number of issues raised too, including infrastructure issues. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's going for the fuel cell and what we might suspect would either lead to that being adopted or maybe work against it.
Well, certainly the thing that is pushing for the adoption of the fuel cell is purely and simply the disadvantages of the internal combustion engine, in particular the pollution that it causes, and secondarily the depletion of the petroleum reserves around the world. So those two things are basically convincing people that at some point in the future we need to find an alternative to the internal combustion engine. If it weren't polluting or we weren't worried about running out of oil at some point in the future, then we wouldn't be looking at things like the fuel cell, basically. So there is not a strong advantage to the fuel cell except when it's compared to the disadvantages of the internal combustion engine or the other ways that we have of generating power. It's not just as a replacement for the internal combustion engine. It's also being looked at as a generation of electricity. But the idea behind the fuel cell is that this is a pretty much environmentally benign sort of technology, that its main byproduct, its main waste product is water. You combine hydrogen and oxygen, as you said, to create electricity, and when hydrogen and oxygen combine, you get water. Now, depending upon the system used to combine the hydrogen and the water, and also the system used to get the hydrogen in the first place, you get various other sorts of waste materials and pollutants. But the generation of the power itself is something that is non-polluting. So that's what's driving it. Now, as you indicated, the main problem that we're facing is, well, there are two main problems. One is just it takes a long time to develop something that's economically viable here. We've been developing the internal combustion engine for over 100 years, and to have something competitive, it's going to take a while to reach that level of development. So efficiency and economics are one problem. The other problem is the infrastructure.
Yeah, that's I was going to say. Yeah, where do you go to fill up your fuel cell car?
Right, and that's actually, there's an interesting story there, because if you're just going to run on hydrogen and oxygen, well, oxygen you can get from the air, but you're going to have to find hydrogen filling stations, which means you're going to have to create those, and then you've got problems about running around with liquid hydrogen in your car, and people are concerned about the possibilities of explosions, and you start worrying about all sorts of things. So that's one possibility, but a better possibility seems to actually be to create the hydrogen on the spot, or to chemically break another compound and create hydrogen. And one of the most intriguing technologies I've seen takes advantage of the fact that we already have this tremendous infrastructure of filling stations, and you've got gasoline out there, and it uses a particular system to take gasoline and break off hydrogen from it, and then use that hydrogen to combine with oxygen to generate electricity and power our car. And it turns out you can use all sorts of things in this system. You could use methanol or ethanol, for instance. And in fact, those may be a little bit better. But the point is that you could create these cars that you fill up with gasoline, but the gasoline's not burned. You actually crack the gasoline inside this, chemical system that pulls the hydrogen out, it combines it with oxygen, and creates electricity. And therefore, you just fill up at a gasoline station. And that may be kind of a midway point between the internal combustion engine and some system of automobiles that runs on either hydrogen or ethanol or something like that, which in the end would probably be better fuels, but we are not ready for those yet. So if you could get these cars out there that you can fill up with gasoline, but also perhaps fill up with methanol, say, that would be a nice stop in on the way. And then gasoline stations would slowly add this new kind of fuel as more of the cars were got out on the road that could use that kind of fuel. And eventually, in a decade or two or three, we might find ourselves moved to a completely different system where gasoline pumps are, there's maybe one gasoline pump in a gas station and everything else is pumping methanol or something else like that, because that most of the cars on the road are using these fuel cells.
It seems that when we think about, when I think about technological change in the past, that it was more the case that it was particularly the kinds of technologies that we've seen developed in the last century, that they were more often revolutionary than evolutionary, but that perhaps in future, do we think that, that the kind of changes that we will see will be more evolutionary than revolutionary?
There's a pattern here. You actually get both. What you have is a new technology appears that can do something that has not been done before. And if there's a need for that, then that new technology is adopted. And that's what you might think of as a revolutionary change, because it is something that simply hasn't been done before. The telephone, the invention of the telephone is a good example. But the invention of the personal computer was a completely equivalent sort of revolution. It allowed people to do something that they had never done before. The Internet is another revolutionary technology. It allows people to do things that simply hadn't been done before. Email, for instance, downloading things from websites. Once that revolution happens, then a long period of development sets in where you build on that technology and you do different developments here and there, and you have an evolutionary period. But it's not an either-or setup at all. You have to have that initial revolution to get started, and the revolution faces some stringent criteria. You have to offer something that hasn't been done before, or if it's been done before, you have to do it enough better than the existing technology that people will move to this new technology. Whereas the evolutionary changes face a very different sort of criteria. You're just looking for something that's a little bit better, because it's easy to adopt the evolutionary changes. The adoption of the revolutionary changes is harder for all the reasons that we've talked about, and therefore you actually have to have a stronger reason to adopt a revolutionary technology than you do just these evolutionary changes.
Well, there we must stop, because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say to you, Mr. Poole, thanks very much for talking with us today.
I enjoyed it.
We appreciate it. Our guest, Robert Poole. And if you'd like to read more on the subject, you should look for his book, which is titled Beyond Engineering, How Society Shapes Technology, published by the Oxford University Press. And then you might look for the program The Next Big Thing. You can see that on our station, WILL-TV, this Sunday at 6, and on also coming soon many other public stations around the country.